Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Morning, and we begin our March arguments this morning. And I'm happy to welcome the Sauk Prairie High School students. Would they stand, please? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. We also have with us, and I'm delighted to welcome, Union Grove Christian School. Would the students please stand? Delighted to welcome you all, and you may be seated. The students are here with us today with the Court with Class program that is sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and the Supreme Court. All the high schools of the state are invited to come and be here and listen to oral argument. These students have received materials about the case we are about to hear and may have done extra class assignments on this case. And as part of this national award-winning program, the students meet with a justice of the court during the noon hour, and there's a discussion about the court's procedures. Everyone is invited to attend. It is an open session, and join the students. Today, the justice who will meet at noon is Justice Sykes, who is sitting on the far left of the bench. And she will meet with you, so you will return to the courtroom and join other students for the noon session. Let me introduce the court to you in addition to Justice Sykes. Next to Justice Sykes is an empty chair. Ordinarily, Justice Crook sits there, but he will not be participating in this case. So to my immediate left is an occupied chair. And that's Justice John Wilcox. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice William Babich, and to his right, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and on the far right, Justice David Prosser. With these introductions made, I'll now call the first case, which is 02-0261, Kenneth Folkman versus Sherry Kwame. Arguing for Society Insurance is James Moore, and he will argue for 25 minutes. Then George Burnett, representing Kenneth Folkman, has 30 minutes, and then Mr. Moore has 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Moore?
Thank you, Ms. Chief Justice and members of the court. Good morning on Fat Tuesday. Happy to be here. And Mr. Burnett, happy to have you as my opponent in this. I'm happy also to represent Society Insurance, the petitioner in this case, and on their behalf, I want to thank you for granting the petition in this case. Society Insurance issued what I think could best be called a standard automobile liability insurance policy. It said very clearly on its declarations page that the limits of liability were $25,000 for any one person injured in an accident, $50,000 for all people injured in an accident. And no one in the trial court or in the Court of Appeals has ever said there's anything confusing about the declarations page. It said it right there. Those are the minimum limits of liability in Wisconsin that a person who purchases insurance can purchase, $25,000 per person, $50,000 per occurrence. To bolster that clear language in the declarations page, the society policy went on to state that those amounts, and my brief, page 6, it's found at several pages, actually also found at page 4 of my brief, but I'm going to be on page 6. Those amounts, and I'm quoting, are the maximum limit of liability for all damages for bodily injuries resulting from any one automobile accident. The maximum, the most, that's it, limits of liability. And no one, to my knowledge, has ever said that that language is ambiguous. Not the trial court, not the Court of Appeals, nor even Mr. Burnett and his law firm in arguing this case has said that that language is ambiguous. Society woke up one morning and found that maximum doesn't mean what maximum apparently we all thought it meant. namely that the $50,000 maximum that this policy says now is $125,000. And why? Because the Court of Appeals disagreed with the trial judge and apparently read the policy to say this is the maximum society will pay for each insured as a result of all injuries sustained in any one accident. The only way they could have come to that conclusion is to add in the language for each insured, and that is in effect their holding. And they did that by claiming that a section in society's policy is ambiguous, a section which I think everyone concedes, including my worthy opponent, is irrelevant. The section is the property damage liability section. And that is found in the portion of every insurance policy that says limits of liability. That portion that I just quoted from is from the limits of liability section. And society admits that there was a typographical error in the printing of its policy. There is a sentence that should have been a separate paragraph and instead was not a separate paragraph. It was appended to the property damage section, and the Court of Appeals said that sentence, therefore, in our opinion, only applies to the property damage section. That's the most property damage we will pay. Well, that's fine, but there is nothing in this case about property damage. This is all personal injury.
And that's the issue, isn't it? I mean, it's this regardless language that would apply basically to both property damage and bodily injury. And
sure, that's...
And if there is a typographical error in a policy, whose responsibility is that? I mean...
Well, it ultimately is certainly the insurance company's responsibility. I don't dispute that. I mean, it's their policy. They wrote it and they issued it. But I don't think it creates any confusion. We can leave that sentence out. Just leave it out. And we come back to the language, this is the maximum we pay. This is the limit. This is the limit of our liability.
But your original intent, I gather, by the concession that this is was a typographical error in the sense the way of the way the policy was set up in by whoever set it up, designed it. The original intent, if I understand it, was that the sentence would say that the limit of liability under any provision of the policy was that it was going to be the maximum you're going to pay regardless of the number of insureds, claims made, vehicles or premiums showed, or vehicles involved in the auto accident. So, and the issue here is the number of insureds, isn't it?
Sure.
Okay.
And whether each insured is entitled to separate coverage.
Right.
We concede that there are three insureds in this case. I'm not disputing that.
It'd be hard to not concede it because they're probably listed as insureds
in the
policy.
I know what I'm
That's
I'm
good.
Wrong.
Okay. But you, whoever drafted this policy was using apparently a belt and suspender approach. That is, the belt was putting in the 25 and 50 and the maximums for individuals and total coverage. And the suspender was saying, yeah, and it doesn't matter how many insureds there are.
Correct.
So what was left off, if I understand your argument, is what was left off was the suspenders here.
Wasn't left off. It was in there. It just, in all other policies I've ever seen, it's in a separate paragraph.
Right.
In this one, it isn't.
It isn't. And then this the pronoun, is that a, this is a pronoun, refers to, in the way it's written now, just the property damage.
Well, that's the Court of Appeals interpretation.
And, and what's your interpretation?
My interpretation is it ought to apply to all the damages. It's in the it's at the end of the limit of liability section.
Even though it's in the property damage liability.
It's in the property damage
paragraph. You want the suspenders even if it's not clear.
Well, maybe I'm tainted because I've read so darn many insurance policies over the years. I know that it's supposed to apply to all of them. But I will concede that it is in the property damage section, and I will concede that it is not unreasonable to say it only applies to the property damage limits of liability.
But do you think it's unreasonable to say if it applies only to property damage, that leaves open the question of whether or not multiple insureds have multiple maximums?
I agree. It is unreasonable to take that position.
That's what your position is.
Absolutely unreasonable. Absolutely, because the language says clearly, and nobody has challenged it, this is the maximum we will pay. couldn't be clearer. This is the most we're going to pay. We will not pay any more than this. This is the maximum. How you can read that to say this is the maximum we will pay for each insured, which is what the Court of Appeals said, the only way you can get to that is by adding language to that. And we all know that you're not supposed to be adding language to policies. The Court, you know, we all know the cases, we're not supposed to construe things so as to rewrite policies to bind an insurer to a risk it has not received compensation for. And that's what happened. And that they're rewriting the policy. How can you take language that says this is the most we will pay and turn it into, well, except when there are more than one insureds, and then this is the most we will pay for each insured?
Did you fix the typographical error?
Have I? I don't.
Insurance company.
I don't know if they have or not. If they followed my advice, they have.
Okay. what I'm getting at is that this is a peculiar case in the sense it may cover a lot of people that were insured, but it's not a standard policy because of the way it's written.
You're absolutely right. This is an unusual case for that reason. But why did they order it published then? That's what bothers me. And so I have used this case as my soapbox to hopefully talk to you a little bit about what you have done in the Schmitz case and what the Court of Appeals has done in Hansen and Dauhauer now and a few other cases in terms of where does this analysis of policies to find ambiguities stop. And I have very strong feelings about Schmitz, as do a lot of my brethren who do insurance defense work.
That's why you're here.
I think that's why I'm here.
Let me further the questioning of the Chief, if I may. And you indicated we have kind of unique facts here, arguably unique in that there are three insureds. That's a little unusual.
Correct.
But even that uniqueness is pronounced by we have an error in the insurance policy that we're construing.
Yes.
And it causes me to wonder, setting aside your arguments on the Schmitz case, the Badger Mutual case, and Dauhauer and other cases that were cited for purposes of how we analyze this. Setting that aside, because that does occupy part of your brief, but that's not the meat of the brief is this case. And I just, as I was preparing, I was wondering, look, we've got unique facts, and we're construing an acknowledged erroneous policy. So what are we doing with this case?
Good question. And why did the Court of Appeals publish that case if it was so isolated? I don't understand that, except to advance this notion that we can start searching out of context of the particular language to find ambiguities, to reinforce what Schmitz held and what cases since then have held. And I think that's wrong. I think in this case, it presents an ideal opportunity for us to put some limits, some brakes on that doctrine, which I think it richly deserves, to be very candid. And in this case, what the Court of Appeals did was to reach into a section of the policy which, by their own admission, was irrelevant, and to say, aha, you could have done it differently in the section which is relevant, and you didn't, and therefore it's ambiguous.
Let's take a look then at the policy split liability limits endorsement, Appendix 138.
Okay.
And I just want to focus on, again, following up on the Chief's questions, what society's error is in this policy. Do you have that page in front of you, Counsel?
I do. Thank you.
So you say that it is error that, in looking at the left-hand column, this is the most we will pay regardless of the number of, that should be a separate paragraph, and that's the error.
Right. I think you said left-hand column. It's in the right-hand column, but that's correct. That should be a separate paragraph.
Thank you. And probably the word this maybe should be changed to these if we're referring to both bodily injury limits and property damage limits?
It could be changed to these, yes.
Generally, when I'm writing, if I say this, I'm talking about
singular.
The thing that was obviously preceding. This is a difficult concept sometimes, and sometimes it's, in my mind, a rather loose concept. You know, this I hold as true. Well, if I've said a few things before that, preceding that, what does this refer to? So it's better probably to say this boot and belt example, I mean, referring specifically, because this sometimes by its nature is ambiguous. I don't ask you to concede or not concede that. I'm just making an observation.
Okay.
So is it your understanding that generally the rules of construction would indicate that this applies to the preceding sentence or the preceding, immediately preceding premise?
If it were a separate paragraph, I would disagree with that. Because it's in this paragraph, I will concede the argument to you that it applies to property damage. But if it's a separate paragraph, I will not concede that it, with all due respect, that it applies only to the property damage limits. I think it's an expression of, this is the most we're going to pay. If they list all the different things, this is it. This is the most we will pay. And I don't think it is grammatically incorrect to phrase it that way, as opposed to the foregoing limits or these limits are the most we will pay.
And in your response, you have, as you did in your brief, though conceded, as it exists written in an erroneous fashion, that this applies only to property damage liability, and you are not asserting that it applies as written to the bodily injury liability.
It should have. It was intended to. But I will concede that in the way it's written here, it's reasonable to conclude it only applies to the property damage limits.
Why are you conceding that?
Because that's a good point. I don't because it just the, unfortunately it was tacked into that paragraph and should have been tacked into a separate paragraph. That's the way it's always written in any other policy.
Well, why is it not quite reasonable to read this paragraph and to read this limiting language in the final sentence of the paragraph to modify everything that comes before it in the limits of liability?
It is reasonable to construe it as applying only to property damage limits. I didn't say that it does. I concede that it is reasonable for a person to conclude, as the Court of Appeals did, that that's one way to write it. You're exactly right. I mean, it could very well be construed to apply to everything before it. And that's the way I always interpreted it.
And why isn't that a manifestly more reasonable construction than the Court of Appeals, based on what this endorsement replaced? Because it replaced language that limited both bodily injury as well as property damage.
I think that's a reasonable construction, but I will admit that I'm tainted by the fact that I read these policies all day long, and I know that it applies to all the limits of liability. All I said was that I don't think it's unreasonable for the Court of Appeals to say, well, it's in that paragraph, therefore it only applies to that paragraph. I think somewhere in my brief I said, obviously, we believe it applies to all the limits of liability, and I still do. But I will concede that I do insurance work all day long, and that may be just my way of looking at it. But I think it applies to all the limits.
Well, there isn't anything that separately sets this language off from the bodily injury language.
You're correct. It doesn't say the limits of liability for property damage are the most we will pay.
Right.
That would make it clearer.
There isn't any separate subheading for bodily injury or separate subheading for property damage. It's all one paragraph. It's just that it happens to continue on a second column.
Right. Right. Yeah. And
why
and
should that make such a big difference in this interpretation?
I don't
think
it does.
Or be given such interpretive importance.
I happen to agree with you. I think it applies to all the limits expressed in that endorsement. But I, as I said before, and I will say again, I don't think it's unreasonable to say, if you view it very strictly, as the Court of Appeals did, that it should only apply to the property damage.
I have a question about the split liability limits. It says schedule, right, in
yes.
the middle.
Yes.
The left-hand column, it says bodily injury liability.
Yes.
Then it has dollar blank each person, dollar blank each accident, dollar blank each accident.
Right.
What does that refer to?
The bodily injury has two limits. You start on the left, bodily injury liability, and read across to the right, you would have blank dollars for each
right.
person, and then
in our case, it would be $25,000 for each person and $50,000 for each accident. Then the next one is property damage. And I
that's how I read it. I read it across so that bodily injury, the schedule was in top, but bodily injury, those three blanks refer to bodily injury. Then
right.
I read property damage liability. That's the heading. And I read the first paragraph of Part A, and then it talks about the limit of liability for each person of bodily injury is our maximum.
Mm-hmm.
And then it keeps going on. And then it goes, the limit of liability for property damage is our maximum.
Mm-hmm.
And then the tag on to the sentence on property damage is your last sentence that we're all debating.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I read all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And is that two paragraphs there, the limit of liability shown in the schedule?
I construe it as being two paragraphs because, although it's not indented, the preceding paragraph, the line that says resulting from any one auto accident, it ends before the margin. And therefore, if it had gone fortuitously to the margin, we might not even be standing here because we could argue this is all one paragraph.
That's how I read it. That's exactly how I read it. So I read the first one doing bodily injury liability, the second dealing with property damage liability, although it also deals with bodily injury. Then you got a third paragraph here that just deals with property damage, right?
It's the second paragraph, yes.
Second paragraph under property damage liability. And the last sentence of that paragraph, paragraph totally related to property damage, is this. And that's where you get the problem that we're debating. I just wanted to make sure I understood how this is drafted.
The limit of liability, there are two paragraphs under it. The first one deals with bodily injury. The second one deals with property damage. And the sentence at issue is appended to the second paragraph.
Second one on property.
Correct.
Okay.
All
right.
But then, the interesting thing about all of this, of course, is that this kind of becomes a little bit of a game because there's no testimony that the insureds ever read the policy or that they were confused or that anyone was confused at the trial court level. This becomes a challenge for the plaintiff's attorneys who are trying to find additional coverage to look in the policy and say, aha, this is ambiguous to me, when there's no evidence in the record that it's ambiguous to anyone else. And therefore throw out the language, even though there's absolutely no evidence that anyone was confused. We focus on these little minute points in here, and all of a sudden, what was a $50,000 policy that we charged and received coverage for is a $125,000 policy. And I don't, with all due respect, I don't think that ought to be a game. I mean, everybody knows what was intended by this policy. The limits on the declarations page say it, $25,000, $50,000.
Counsel, are you advancing the position that 17-year-old, and I give the age because that'll maybe entice some of the listeners here, that the 17-year-old son driver should have read the policy in order for them to pursue this claim of coverage?
No.
No, you're not.
No.
Now, you come up with some proposals, and one proposal is, in your brief, that maybe there should be, though, some testimony about the intent and that they read the policy and were they confused. But you're not really asserting that with regard to saying that there should be testimony that 17-year-old Keith was confused before there was coverage.
No, I'm not. I'm just saying that we shouldn't be playing the kind of game where someone totally unrelated to the policy now has the opportunity to take a look at it, seize on some minute error in the policy, and say, aha, the insurance company loses because of that.
I want to just follow up on Justice Sykes' question. Page 8 of the slip opinion of the Court of Appeals notes that you did not argue that the phrase, this, applies to bodily injury or is a reasonable interpretation. It applies to the bodily injury paragraph. In fact, page 8 indicates, indeed, society does not argue that it does. Are you changing now and arguing that a reasonable interpretation of this applies to the bodily injury?
No. First of all, we didn't have oral argument in the Court of Appeals. Second, I'm sure I pull out my Court of Appeals brief, but I'm sure I said in there that obviously we believe it applies to everything, but I didn't go beyond that.
I
didn't go beyond it in my brief to this court either because, you know, what can I say beyond that? I think it applies, but I will concede it's in the same paragraph and should have been in a separate paragraph.
I understood your argument to be that you don't even need it.
You're right.
So it's not that it applies, it's just that it's surplusage, actually.
Like as Justice Abramson said, it's the suspenders in addition to the belt. But I somewhere in this brief, and I can find it when I sit down and Mr. Burnett argues, I'm sure I said somewhere in this brief that obviously I believe it applies to all claims. But it doesn't matter because I don't need it. We can leave that whole sentence out, and the applicable section of the policy is still unambiguous. It says this is the most we will pay. How can you pay more than the most we will pay? I mean, to me, that's just obvious. And so I don't think we need it. I think it's surplusage, as you put it, but it was intended to make something clearer, and unfortunately, they didn't put it in a separate paragraph. So fine, leave it out. Ignore it. It's in a section that is irrelevant to this case. Then we come back to the language. This is the most we will pay. How can it be anything more than the most we will pay?
Mr. Moore, you said a few moments ago that you wanted to be on your soapbox.
Yes.
And you wanted to criticize a number of cases, the Schmitz case and the Dauhauer case. And yet I didn't see any reference to the Dauhauer case in your brief.
It was decided after the briefs were filed. The most recent Dauhauer case is the one I'm referring to.
Well, but the Dauhauer case that is the seminal case that led to the Schmitz case is not cited.
Right.
There's a proposition of law in that case. We recognize that a reducing clause may be ambiguous within the context of the insurance contract.
Yes.
Is that an inaccurate statement of law?
You read it correctly. And I think it is the law in Wisconsin. And I happen to, it was the Schmitz case that made me shudder for some reason, not the Dauhauer case.
Well, did you like the policy in the Schmitz case?
The Schmitz case, once again, as I recall, was a reducing clause case. And my recollection is, and I apologize, I'm not familiar with the facts of Schmitz, it was the principle of Schmitz that I was arguing about. In none of those cases did I find the language to be ambiguous. And I think this court said the language complied with the statute. It parroted or went along with the statute. And yet when you look at it in the whole context of all the table of contents and where one has to go to find it in the policy and compare it to what's in the declarations page, that in that context it becomes very difficult to read and therefore is ambiguous.
Well, in the Schmitz case, there was no reference to an underinsured motorist coverage on the declarations page.
Yes.
To me, it's a little bit like a Where's Waldo game. If you find Waldo, there's Waldo. But an insurance policy should not be a treasure hunt, a maze, shouldn't there be a little clarity in an insurance policy?
That's always the goal. Now let me get up in my soapbox a little bit, if I may. These insurance policies, every insurance company wants to write a clear policy. There is no company in the world that I know of that wants to write an obscure policy.
That's not in the record. And I don't want to be,
I know it isn't.
I don't mean to be cute here, but it would be so simple to put something on the declarations page about underinsured motorist coverage and to do a lot better job than the particular company in that case did. I think it's extremely difficult to defend. Now, the principle of ambiguity in context, you raise a good point that perhaps needs to be clarified. But would you want us to overrule the Schmitz case?
No. I didn't ask for overruling of the Schmitz case. I asked for some guidance to insurance companies. As one of my clients put it, we don't know where the court's going to strike next. We don't know what context it's going to happen in. And we'd like to be able to know so we can charge for it, as they put it.
Well, perhaps,
but they don't know.
Perhaps the court didn't know where the insurance company is going to strike next.
The policies are essentially the same. These are the same policies with minor revisions, I agree. As insurance commissioners tell us, we have different requirements, as legislatures pass new laws and as this court issues new decisions, those policies get tweaked to match those up. But in general terms, those policies are the same year after year after year until a huge revision comes along, like once every 15 or 20 years, the insurance services office may change its policy forms. But other than that, those policies are essentially the same year after year. And they're not models of clarity, I will admit that. I mean, I spend a lot of time reading those things. Most contracts that are written by business organizations aren't models of clarity as much as we'd like to think they are. They're very dense and difficult to read documents. What you're asking the insurance industry to do, and doing it to the detriment of Wisconsin insurers, is to rewrite this whole policy and make it clear. And maybe that is a goal they ought to try to do. I think a number of years ago they went to what was called an easy read policy with some marginal success, because the provisions in those policies were different in wording than all of the policies that preceded them and the cases that interpreted that language. And insurance companies feel very comfortable with language that has been interpreted by the courts and has been understood and given meaning, and they tend to stick with that language, even though it may be a little dense and may have words that are archaic in it. But they feel somewhat comfortable in knowing that this is the way it gets interpreted. You try and write those policies on a nationwide basis, and society is no exception. They write a policy here which in all respects mirrors most common automobile policies, and yes, they have to add on a Wisconsin endorsement to meet particular Wisconsin rules, and they add on the split liability endorsement here, and that's how those policies are written. Would it be easier to write it in letter form to an insured? Here's the coverage you got. Yes, it would. It would be very long policy, long letter, though. And expensive, too, because it'd have to be written on a case-by-case basis.
Counsel, do you disagree, and it isn't clear to me, do you disagree with this premise that an unambiguous clause should be read together with the rest of the policy to determine if the clause is susceptible of more than one construction? Do you agree or disagree with that?
As a general rule, I disagree with that.
That was what Justice Crooks wrote in his dissenting opinion in Badger Mutual, and he cited the estate of Dorschner and versus State Farm for that premise. He also indicated, I agree with the majority that Dauhauer and Taylor recognize that language in an insurance policy can be ambiguous within the context of the whole policy, those being at paragraphs 79 and paragraphs 80 of the dissent. So you are disagreeing with the premise that is set forth both in the majority and in the dissent in the Schmitz case. Is that correct?
I'm trying to say what I said in my brief, or hoped I said in my brief, that if the language you're reading is unambiguous, it should be construed as it stands. If the language requires you to refer to another section in the policy by its terms or by implication, then obviously you have to then compare those two sections of the policy. But if
so
it doesn't require
read,
it should be construed
so
as it stands.
So what I read from the dissent, which was joined by Justice Wilcox and Justice Sykes, that the unambiguous UIM reducing clause should be read together with the rest of the policy to determine if the reducing clause is susceptible of more than one construction, and that the dissent agrees with the majority that Dauhauer and Taylor recognize that language in insurance policy can be ambiguous within the context of the whole policy. You disagree with the three members of the dissent and the four members of the majority for that premise.
Well, I think that may be putting it a little too broadly. You read me one sentence.
I don't want to. Tell me. You said you disagreed with the dissent.
Are you agreeing with
the majority?
I disagreed with what you read me, because I believe that if a policy provision is clear as it stands, it ought to be enforced. Now, if that policy provision requires you, by implication or by direct language, to refer to another section of the policy, then you have to. And those two sections of the policy have to be read together so that you get the essential meaning out of it. Now, if there's an inconsistency,
I
you try and resolve that inconsistency by giving effect to both sections of the policy.
I want to be fair. I misspoke when I said you disagree with the dissent, but you disagree with those quoted provisions in the paragraphs I noted, those sentences in the dissent you disagree with.
That sentence that you read me, I do. As a general rule, I said. Mm-hmm. My red light has been on for some time, so unless there's anything else, I'm going to sit down.
Well, you may sit down.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Moore. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Burnett, representing Kenneth Folkman and others.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. My intention to cover in this argument today, time permitting, is four issues. The first issue is the micro view of this case. What does this particular policy mean, and why, in my view, is it ambiguous? The second is the topic that Mr. Moore just left, and that is Badger Mutual versus Schmitz, and did this court do anything that was radical or revolutionary in that case in the way it reads insurance policies? The third issue is whether or not this court's decision in Blazkowicz has some meaning for this case, and how 632.32 subpart 5 may control the analysis of this insurance policy. And the last issue is whether or not the Mills case and the omnibus statute conflict, and the Mills case should be overruled. With that introduction, let me turn to the main focus of what I think society's argument is, and that is this, that the passage in its policy that says, quote, the limit of liability is our maximum limit of liability for all damages, covers the subject, and nothing further need be said. Society has said in its brief and in its argument today that the unambiguity of that phrase has been conceded, both by the Court of Appeals and by the plaintiffs. That is not precisely accurate. At page 24 through 26, and especially at page 26 of the plaintiff's brief, we contested the ambiguity of that phrase. At paragraphs 12 and 13 of the Court of Appeals decision, the Court of Appeals decision has said that phrase is not as clear as it could be as well. In both cases, in both situations, the argument was simply this, that as you read that phrase, you cannot tell whether or not an insured must split these liability limits with other insureds if they both happen to be liable out of the same accident, like this case, or whether multiple insureds each have separate and independent policy limits. As you read that phrase, it just doesn't answer that question. The next step for a reasonable insured in analyzing the policy would be to read, as the court did in Badger Mutual versus Schmitz, the policy as a whole. And in this situation, reading the policy as a whole might clarify the situation, but in this situation, it makes it worse. It makes it murkier. If you start at the declarations page, you see no answer to that question. Do multiple insureds who are liable from the same accident share a policy limits, or is each entitled to a separate one? If you go to the insuring clause, it doesn't answer the question, but it certainly suggests they are. The insuring clause grants coverage to any insured legally responsible for damages. It says nothing about dividing or splitting or sharing policy limits, but what it does say is any insured is covered. If one goes to the dictionary, as this court commonly does, it finds that a meaning of the word any is every. So if you are to read this grant of coverage, as this court has said many times in many cases, broadly to confer coverage, it means that every insured is entitled to coverage for their legal responsibility for damages. This coincides with the impression that people have about insurance policies. When you go buy an insurance policy from your agent, you ask for your coverage. And when, for those of us who have teenage children, when you go and you ask that your teenage son or daughter be added to the policy, you get extra coverage and you pay an extra premium for that. As I thought about this case, And why there is such a disparity between society's view and the plaintiff's view, it occurred to me that there's a failure of communication, a failure of expectations. I think that most people in this society believe that insurance companies, insurance policies insure people. So when you look at the industry advertising, you see that the company selects a name that might protect you, a Century or a Guardian or words like that. Allstate is you're in good hands. State Farm is a good neighbor. This connotes protection for people. But as you read the arguments from the insurance industry's lawyers, what they are essentially saying is the industry doesn't insure people, it insures cars.
Counsel, isn't that the general premise that this kind of a automobile liability policy goes with the car?
Well, sometimes yes, sometimes no. I mean, in our stacking cases before the legislature stepped in, the policy traveled regardless of whether it was involved with the car or not. But I don't think anybody, when they buy an insurance policy, expects that I get the coverage I bought for the car, nothing more, nothing less. I think when you have multiple insureds, you expect multiple coverages.
What difference does it make whether or not Mary Smith, sitting in Prairie du Sac, says, I don't know if this coverage goes with the person or the car. I think I intend that it go with the person rather than the car. I mean, here's a contract.
Right.
Here's a contract. What does it say?
That's exactly right. It doesn't matter on what the insured subjectively believes. It matters what an objective what the average insured in the position of a policyholder would read the policy to mean. That's the objective standard. And that's what's wrong, one of the things that's wrong with this modest proposal that society puts forward to somehow or other cure the century-old rule that this court has applied in analyzing insurance policies. Suddenly it becomes a subjective standard. No longer do we read contracts objectively.
Mr. Burnett, I'd like to ask you a little bit about this policy. This is a policy that in part is designed to comply with the sponsorship statute.
Yes.
And as I understand it, the policy that was issued covers the father, the mother, and the two children.
Yes.
All right. Is this a fairly normal policy in that regard?
You mean
in the way that a single policy covers the whole family?
Yes.
Right. Now, you want to interpret that policy that every one of those insureds is a multiple of the coverage on the declarations page. Is that right?
In a situation where they are separately responsible to a victim in an accident, yes.
Well, in any accident involving a minor who has been sponsored, let's say the minor is driving, isn't the minor and one or both parents always going to be responsible?
Yes, if the parents are married and living together, yes.
Okay, so that the normal case would be plaintiff versus driver child plus the two parents, or one parent in the right case, as defendants.
Right.
Now, we've had a sponsorship statute since 1928.
Right.
Has there ever been an insurance policy in which the multiple insureds has been taken to mean you take each one of them and multiply it times the coverage of the policy?
There is a line of cases that goes both ways. And I'll just answer you off the top of my head. The Groth case, G-R-O-T-H, which was decided in the 30s, talks about the issue. The Anderson book on Wisconsin insurance law, you will find a passage that that covers this subject. And it always, if I recall it correctly, depends on what the terms of the policy say. But that is a question that lends itself very well to the last point I wanted to discuss, and that's whether or not the law of Wisconsin requires separate coverage. And if we look at the omnibus statute before subpart 5 was added to it, we have 632.32 sub 3. And that statute says that coverage extends to any person legally responsible for a vehicle. Now, in the Mills decision, the Court of Appeals said the extension of coverage does not mean the extension of policy limits. And I think that if one looks at Mills and Miller versus Amundsen and Iaquinta versus Allstate and Lansinger as a quartet of cases that talk about these issues, you find two things. You find a rule that's announced in Mills and Lansinger that says the omnibus statute does not extend coverage, separate policy limits, to those who are very vicariously liable. Miller and Iaquinta says the omnibus statute does extend coverage to those who are actively negligent. So in Miller, a mom and a grandma were driving in a truck, and a little kid was in the back. The little kid toppled out of the truck, and mom and grandma got sued because neither were effectively watching the child. The Court of Appeals said under the omnibus statute, there are separate policy limits conferred. The reason I urge that this Court overrule Mills is that the distinction between actively negligent tortfeasors and vicariously liable tortfeasors is found nowhere in the omnibus statute. When the legislature said coverage extends to any person legally responsible for the vehicle, a logical conclusion from that is that by extending coverage, one is also extending policy limits, and that one doesn't subtract policy limits from one insured in order to confer those policy limits on another. And the last point I'd make on that is that that's consistent with the underlying purpose of the omnibus statute, which is to expand coverage, protect policyholders, not to contract it. Justice? So,
under your omnibus statute argument, any time that there is a sponsorship cause of action, and I'll use that as shorthand, then the liability limits are enhanced by the number of the insureds. Is that correct?
The number of sponsors, because
those are insureds.
That's right.
Let me set aside your statutory arguments, that the arguments you advance that the policy is violative of the omnibus or the drive other car exclusion or stacking, and just stay with the first argument, which is what the Court of Appeals responded to and only addressed. Setting your statutory arguments 2, 3, 4, and 5 as they are in my mind aside, and staying with the first argument, which is the subject of the Court of Appeals opinion, if this policy of insurance, the endorsement, split liability limits, if it had annexed to the first paragraph the regardless of the number of insureds clause, would you be here?
Probably. And let me tell you why. Just as Mr. Moore is a true believer on one side, I'm a true believer on the other. And I think the problem is this. The problem is that insurance companies write these contracts, and they have important implications for the financial welfare of families across the state. And they're very important for the insurance companies as well, because they have millions of dollars of risk riding on them. I think at a minimum, those companies, when writing the contract, should follow common ordinary rules of grammar. And the word this, as Justice Sykes was talking about, is problematic here. It's problematic because, as you pointed out, it is very imprecise.
The phrase, this is the most we will pay regardless of the number of insureds, put that on the end, not only as it appears now, the property damage paragraph, but put it at the end of the limit on bodily injury. Why is this problematic in that?
Because the word this is singular, and there are two bodily injury liability limits, one for per person, one for per accident.
Fair enough. If it was these, then would you be here? If next to the paragraph in the split liability limits was the following sentence, as made part of the last sentence of that paragraph, these limits are the most we will pay regardless of the number of, number one, insureds, two, claims made, et cetera. Would you be here?
Probably not. But it is often on those small words that important rights depend. And that is one of the reasons that I think this Court did not err in its decision in Badger Mutual versus Schmitz. You've pointed out already, in as far as the methodology goes that the Court applied, the Court's decision was unanimous there. And as Justice Prosser pointed out, the Court's methodology was the same in Dauhauer. And if you look at the third case in that trilogy, Taylor versus Greatway, the methodology was the same in that case. And the reason the methodology was the same is that the rule has been in existence in this state for 100 years or more. The Court always construes a contract as a whole. It is not unreasonable to expect a written contract to, with various passages, to agree. We're told today that somehow or other a contract that the Court shouldn't look to determine whether or not a contract has conflicting parts because that is somehow out of line with the direction that the law should take. And in fact, I think the law has been fairly unanimous, fairly uniform for a long period of time that you construe contracts as a whole. And this is not just a rule that's applied to insurance contracts. This is a rule that's applied to contracts across the board. There's a good reason for that, and that is that the party drafting the contract has a strong advantage, but they also have a important responsibility, and that responsibility is to lend clarity to the contract. And as this Court said in General Casualty versus Hills, the penalty for not drafting a clear contract is that it is construed against you. And it is fair to construe a contract against the party who creates an ambiguity than it is to penalize the insured, the policyholder, who had no role in drafting the contract in the first place. The modest proposal that society proposes here reverses that burden. What it does is it makes it incumbent on a policyholder to read the contract, to think about it in the abstract, to call their agent or some bureau at the insurance company to discuss the policy language, and supposes that this insurance company would be willing to modify its ISO forms on a policy-by-policy holder basis. If it is the objective of this Court in analyzing these policies to set important public policy, this procedure will not create clearer policies. It will engender all the more confusion. In addition, it will add two sets of rules, one set of rules for insurance contracts and a second set of rules for other contracts construed in the state of Wisconsin.
Counsel, you make four statutory arguments, that is, that this policy is violative of four statutory provisions. Which of the four is your strongest argument?
The one I mentioned under 632.32 sub 3A or 3B. The second strongest is the argument under Blaskovic.
That is the 632.32.5F argument. In referring to that argument, your 5F deals with uninsured motorist provisions, or underinsured motorist coverage, rather. So why do you think 5F applies here?
I think 5F has an extension that's far broader. 5F says a policy may provide that regardless of the number of policies involved, vehicles involved, persons covered, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it applies to any policy issued in the state of Wisconsin. And the scope of the law, 632.32 sub 1, says so because that says, except as otherwise provided, this statute applies to every policy of insurance issued or delivered in this state.
What about the argument that 5F, though, was enacted as part of the 1995 or 1996 legislation, I forget which year, dealing with the anti-stacking decisions, and that this has been referred to as a clause and others following it, I think G, H, maybe an I, also enacted at the same time to deal with some of those anti-stacking opinions.
That's the circuit court's holding. I say two things. First of all, I say that this particular policy passage is an anti-stacking provision. And second, the scope of the statute is not broader. It is not written narrowly to apply just to stacking. It adopts the language of limit of liability clauses which the insurance industry has used for a long period of time. So we see the statute talking about a policy may provide that regardless of the number of policies involved, vehicles involved, persons covered, et cetera. That's verbatim from limit of liability clauses. There is no better proof than this particular passage, this limit of liability clause, is an anti-stacking clause than society's own policy. If we look at society's uninsured motorist passages, which I believe are at appendix page 140. You will find a clause that is virtually identical. And if you peruse the policy and you look for another clause that might be an anti-stacking clause, you will not find one. And if you peruse the policy and look for one, a clause that carries the same language regardless of the number of policies involved, vehicles involved, persons covered, et cetera, you will not find one.
Isn't there one in the MedPay provision also?
Oh, there probably is, and there's probably, if this has UIM coverage, there's probably one in there too. But the important point is that a limit of liability clause is an anti-stacking clause. They're written together.
Is your argument then with regard to sub F, and I'm looking at that language, regardless of the number of policies involved, we only have one policy here, so that doesn't apply. Vehicles involved, well, that's not what's in question here. Persons covered. Now, persons covered is something different than persons insured. Is that correct?
Well, I would read that as synonymous.
Persons covered is the same as persons insured?
I think so.
What about if you're a guest passenger and you're covered? Are you necessarily an insured?
If it's a liability policy and you're using the vehicle, yes. So
is permissive use an insured? Permissive use,
yes.
User an insured also?
Yes.
Okay.
So I regard the words coverage and the words insured as synonymous, and the reason I do that is because of 632.32 sub 3B. That's the language that's used. Coverage extends in the earlier statute. And my point on sub F is that this allows one type of limit of liability clause, a limit of liability clause that allows a carrier to preclude adding limits for similar coverage based on the number of vehicles under the policy. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
The Blaskovic is important to that argument because Blaskovic talks about what subpart 5 of 632.32 means. And Blaskovic says the words permissible provisions mean something in this statute, and what it means is that some of these policy provisions are allowed and some are forbidden. So in Blaskovic, you had a drive other car exclusion that didn't comply with subpart 5J, and this court held that because it didn't comport with subpart 5J, it was an invalid provision. And in response to the insurer's argument that says, well, this was part of tort reform and it permits any drive other car exclusion, the court responded, if any drive other car exclusion was permitted, the statute would not be written with specific requirements, and it's a prohibitory statute because otherwise there would be no need for it. I should return to the policy at issue here, and in the last few moments I have, make one additional point. The additional point is this, that the language that society says is dispositive, the limit of liability is our maximum limit for all damages, appears in the property damage passage as well. So the argument that they ultimately make fails perhaps because if this language were clear, there would be no need for further language that says this is the most we will pay regardless of the number of insureds.
What's so unclear about it?
The word this is singular, so you don't know what the, are you talking about the
talking about the limit of liability is our maximum limit of liability for all damages for bodily injury resulting from any one auto accident. What's unclear about that?
It's because it doesn't tell you whether it is their maximum limit per insured or their maximum limit for the entire occurrence.
Why is it at all reasonable to suppose that it means something other than what it says in the case of multiple insureds?
Because it doesn't say whether it means whether it applies, whether it means that multiple insureds must split a liability limit, or whether or not they are entitled to their own. The problem is not with the words selected. The problem is with what they leave out.
Well, is there anything about that language that suggests more coverage in the case of more than one insured?
If you read it in conjunction with the insuring clause, yes, which says any insured is covered for their legal responsibility for an accident. That means every insured is covered.
That doesn't operate to increase the policy limits, though. That language can't reasonably be construed to increase the policy limits.
Mm-hmm. I guess I would disagree. I think that when you promise any insured coverage, you promise them by implication separate policy limits. And if the implication is to be dispelled, it is the responsibility of the drafter of the policy to dispel it. That's I guess that's the best I can do in answering the question.
But for extra insureds over the husband and wife, there's a charge?
I don't know if that's spelled out in the declarations page or not. I just said that that was common practice. And
now, depending, I think, probably on how the opinion is written, assuming we would hold for your client, assuming we hold for your client on the basis of ambiguity and construction against the insurance company, does that affect every standard policy, auto policy, written?
It depends on how you write the opinion. If you write the opinion to say that the passage on which society relies is inadequate to dispel the impression that I just mentioned, in which the Court of Appeals also indicated was there as well, and that the passage, this is the most because it's appended to the property damage paragraph, it doesn't clarify the situation, the answer in a long way is no, it will not affect, I would suspect, 99% of the policies issued in the state of Wisconsin. If the court writes the policy to say that the use of the word this is singular, so that even if it is in the separate paragraph immediately below that Mr. Moore says it should have been, or if it's in the separate paragraph and in fact repeated after the bodily injury limits, then it probably would.
What about if we take one of your statutory arguments, and I gather your strongest one you thought was a 630-232-3B, what does that do to every insurance policy in the state?
Well, that will provide coverage to sponsors as a matter of statute. And it may, it probably will provide coverage to though anyone who's vicariously liable, partners, employers, et cetera.
When you say provide coverage, then you have to overrule Mills. To give them the max, each one of them the max, you have to overrule Mills.
Mills, and I think Lansinger as well.
Mills and Lansinger. So, and that's a much broader opinion.
Yes.
Okay.
Could I ask you, Mr. Burnett, there are four insureds under this policy. What is the maximum amount under your interpretation that the insurance company might have to pay out?
$125,000. They've already conceded $50,000, so that the difference is $75,000. And the way that works is on Ken Folkman Jr.'s accident, you have additional sponsorship liability of both parents. So Keith and Deborah, or Ken Sr. and Deborah, would both sponsor Keith's license, and that would give you an additional $25,000 for each. And then,
But I think you're not understanding my question. Suppose another person were injured. What is the maximum amount with four insureds that you say could be paid out under this policy?
If it would depend on who was injured. So, for example, in Deborah's case, she too was injured, but there's only one sponsor involved, her husband, and then the driver. And there's a per accident limit in the policy as well. So, off the top of my head, my suspicion is it's probably limited at $50,000 per accident for each sponsor.
If the father had been in the car and he had been injured?
Then driver would be responsible to him, but the liability would be capped at per accident of $50,000. And his wife would be responsible as the sponsor, and her responsibility would be capped at $50,000. Does that answer your question? Sort of?
Close enough.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Burnett. Mr. Moore.
Thank you. Justice Prosser, in answer to your question, the amount of insurance coverage under their scenario is almost unlimited. It's limited only by how many people you can pack into the car. Let's assume, for the sake of argument, that we had two sponsors in the car plus two other passengers, and they hit a car full of kids so that there are multiple injuries in the other car, and it's all our driver's fault. The driver, under his scenario, would be entitled to $50,000 in coverage. The two sponsors in the car would be entitled to $50,000 in coverage. If there were two passengers who were telling the driver how to drive, turn left here, hurry up and make this pass, cut around him on the right, And if the court finds that by giving those instructions they were using the car with the permission of the owner, they would also be insured under his scenario. Therefore, we have five people, each of whom could get $550,000 in coverage, or a maximum in my scenario of $250,000, because they're all potential insureds under the policy, either because they're drivers, sponsors, or they're using the vehicle. And that's what makes this, you know, the argument so bizarre, because we take a $25,000-$50,000 policy, and if their doctrine is adopted, it becomes who knows how many insureds. It could be, under my scenario, $250,000 in coverage.
But as I understand the plaintiff's argument, it makes the per accident $50,000 upper limit totally meaningless.
Totally meaningless. It's fortuitous, depending on how many insureds there are in the car. That's exactly right.
It writes it completely out of the policy.
Absolutely. And absolutely. That's what's so frustrating about this argument. Is that
it might as well not even be there.
We charge a premium for $25,50, and all of a sudden now we've got an exposure in this case of $125,000, but could easily be $200,000, $250,000, depending on how many people are in the car and can be construed as insureds under the policy. And the point that he made in his argument is that, and he said it several times, Mr. Burnett, that the insurance company is insuring cars. They don't care about people. We have to extend coverage to the sponsors. We did extend coverage to the sponsors in this case. The parents were absolutely covered. Everybody in that car who had any liability was covered. We're not denying them coverage. The only issue is how much we pay. There was never any issue raised in the trial court that we denied coverage to the two sponsors. They are all covered. They are all insured. We extend coverage to them under the omnibus statute, but we don't pay more than our limits. The limits of liability, all they paid for was $25,50. And his statement that insurance policies carry substantial financial implications for the people of the state, absolutely they do. There's one way to get around it. Buy more insurance. If you want more coverage, just pay for it. They paid for a policy of $25,000, $50,000 in coverage. And everybody knows it's $25,000 for one person, $50,000 for the whole accident. That's what the policy says. That's the most we're going to pay.
Counsel, how do you respond to the answer of your opposing counsel to my question? My question was, if the regardless of the number of insureds phrase appeared at the end of the first paragraph referring to bodily injury, and he said, and if this were changed to these, that he would not be here but for that error in placement in the word this. How do you respond to that? Essentially I hear him saying, look, if that error of society had not been made, we wouldn't have an argument regarding ambiguity as long as you changed this to these also.
Well, you know, there's always something in a policy you can change, and it may be clearer to one person and not clearer to another person. I don't think an error, I will admit that, yes, I think reasonably, because based on all other policies, that language should have been put in a separate paragraph. I don't think that's what's left is ambiguous. I don't think his suggestion makes our language ambiguous. I don't think his suggestion makes it any significantly clearer. It is clear enough to me that this is the most we will pay. This is our maximum. I don't know what more you can do on that. I'm happy to hear that if we make that change, we may be able to avoid at least this kind of litigation in the future, and maybe we'll make that change. But I honestly don't believe that what we got here is ambiguous in the least, with all due respect. Justice Sykes, in answer to one of your earlier questions, I did find the portion in my brief to this court about that. It's at the bottom of page 13 where I said, society obviously believes the sentence identifying this is the most we will pay regardless of the number of insureds applies to all claims. And so I did concede that. I did not, I find, make that same argument in the Court of Appeals brief, and it was an oversight. The other question that I want to talk about briefly is this notion that that we must extend separate limits of liability to the sponsors and to anyone else who might be vicariously liable in the case. And that issue, as has been noted, has been put to rest, I thought, by Mills and Lansinger. And Mills said, and I'm quoting, and where it repeats the holding of Lansinger, it says, Lansinger holds that each person to whom the negligence of another is imputed is not entitled to policy limits protection under 632.32. We did extend coverage to those that are vicariously liable, but that doesn't mean that they get separate policy limits. You have to rewrite the policy to come to that conclusion. The policy says this is the maximum we pay. They're all covered. If you want more coverage than that, all you have to do is buy more coverage than that. I want to thank you. My time is up. It was a pleasure, as always, to be in front of you.
Thank you, Mr. Moore, and thank you, Mr. Burnett, for excellent arguments in this case involving policy interpretation and statutory interpretation. And that ends our hearing on 02-0261, Folkman versus Kwame. The court will take a few moments in recess so those who are leaving may leave and that other students who are arriving may come in. And then we will feed promptly to the second case this morning.